Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for the virtual launch of Over Here, The Last Trial by Scott Turow. The reason I'm looking over there, that's my advanced reading copy, because the copies that, oh, look, one from Scott. Yay. Hi. So nice of you to have a copy and to join us. Scott signed copies for us, and they are on their way to us, and they probably will be here at the end of the week. So if you're interested in an autographed copy, now's your chance to buy one. So that was my sales pitch. Anyway, congratulations, Scott. This is how many books? I forgot to count.
14 books, 12 novels. So it's starting to be a career.
I am holding up my favorite of all your books. Yeah. It's still my favorite. 50 years, 50 plus years later now.
Yeah, 40, 40 plus.
40 yeah. plus, right? And I think the story of how you came to write it is fascinating. So I was thinking, there was a great interview with you in, must have been the Chicago Sun-Times, in which, I think it was, commenting that one of the reasons you wrote The Last Trial was that you were interested in writing about aging.
Yeah, for sure.
But I thought it might be fun to talk for a few minutes about beginnings, because that's something I think as we get older, we dwell on more and more. You and I have some oddly interesting parallels in our lives. You
yes.
were born in Chicago. I'm
yes.
born in Evanston. We both went to New Trier.
Yes.
I think I was probably, let's see, I was class of 58. So what am I, a decade ahead of you?
Not quite, but I was class of 66.
So New Trier, I thought, was a high school that functioned in a higher level than we might often assume high schools do. We both got mm-hmm. a really great general education.
Yeah, I had my gripes about being a student at New Trier, which had to do with my parents moved out of the city of Chicago when I was a freshman at New Trier. So I never fit in socially, and that was unappetizing. On the other hand, you know, and I remember walking out of the school thinking, I will never set foot in this place again, and then sent three children there, all of whom, by the way, have their gripes with New Trier, but they do a phenomenal job as a public high school, just incredible. And I think, frankly, the level of preparation is even more unusual today than in our era. And I know my kids were all really good students and went to, you know, very good schools, two to Stanford, one to Amherst, and none of them felt that they were underprepared when they got to those places, and often better prepared than their colleagues. So, That is the big plus of New Trier, is the education. It is still a place woefully lacking in diversity. And that goes back to our days there. And in fact, Barbara, it is probably, if you want to talk about race, that is African Americans, less diverse than when we were there. And my kids all ended up objecting to that. They didn't think they had been educated in the real world.
Well, I can't argue with that. I think my experience at the end of the 50s, you know, there's a tremendous divide between the end of the 50s and the 1960s.
Yes.
My husband is 5 years younger than I am. And truly, in many ways, he relates better to my kids than he does to me, because I'm serious. He's the real child of, you know, the late 60s. And I still remember the first time my younger daughter met him, she looked at me, he was shaving his head. He had a pearl earring. He had a tattoo or whatever it was. And Susan looked at me and she said, Mom, if I'd brought him home, you wouldn't have let him in. But anyway, I'm always conscious of that divide. But I think you're right. In the school of life, it may have been lacking, but in terms of academic preparation, they did a fabulous job.
Yeah, and they still do. And they deserve tremendous credit for that.
So you went on to Amherst, and then you went to Stanford on a Stegner Fellowship.
Right.
I went straight to Stanford, and Wallace Stegner, I have to say, was the literary giant of the campus. You know, he was like an especially tall person walking around at Stanford. And then I went off and eventually wound up reading the law in Virginia. I don't know if I ever told you that.
You say reading the law? Are you being...
I did. No, I'm really serious. I got there in various byways. I went back to North... I had a couple of master's degrees. And when I got to Virginia and was married to a lawyer, they thought that I'd been in school long enough. And so I was still able to do the Virginia Bar Attorney Apprentice Program.
Wow. Wow. You know, I think you told me that a few years ago when we were together, but I had, because it's now starting to ring a bell, but you are part of a very, very small breed in the United States who read the law, which is what they call it when you didn't go to law school. It goes without saying that the ABA has tried to stamp that out because they want to have control over the law schools. But that's a really neat credential.
Well, I brought it up for this reason, not to talk about me, but I still remember, because I was in that program, the judges were allowed to qualify me to do anything they thought I was capable of doing, even though I hadn't graduated from law school. And there was no public defender program in Southwest Virginia. So I was incredibly popular because I worked for free. And I was so proud. I came out of court in Abington and I had won an argument, a motion against another attorney. And I remember he looked at me and he said, "Great job." And he said, "But you're never going to be a great lawyer." And I thought, that was so mean, you know? And then he looked at me and he said, "You're never going to be a great lawyer because you're not in love with the law."
Hmm.
I will tell you, Scott, that I have thought about that over the years, wondering what he meant. It's one reason I have a bookstore and didn't take the Arizona bar exam when I could have gone to law school here and did it. And I am so grateful to you for the last trial, because on reading it, I finally understood what he meant. You are a person who really is in love with the law, and Sandy Stern is a person who is really in love with the law. And I don't think I ever really got it till I reread your book this afternoon.
Huh. Well, that's a nice remark. It's where the New York Times review today ends about Stern, that, you know, his lofty appreciation of the law. Can we go back for just one second, though? I certainly want to talk about my book, but I can't let the mention of Wally Stegner pass by without without saluting Wally and Dick Scowcroft, who was his successor as director of the Writing Center, and then Nancy Packer, who succeeded Dick. They were all enormous influences in my life as a young writer. And Wally, who really was a great eminence, and was, however you define it, a major American author, and still beloved of millions of readers. He was, in many ways, an incredibly humble, incredibly decent man. And, you know, he was a loyal friend to me till the end of his life. And he just, he had a very simple approach to writing, in the sense that he refused to be glamorous. He refused to glamorize it. He didn't hold with, you know, bohemian theories about creativity, or, you know, the poet is the antenna of the race. It was a job, he taught us. And if you don't put your butt in the chair every day and write, you're never going to finish a novel, and you're not doing your work. And as simple as that sounds, it was a remarkably important lesson, especially to give to a bunch of young writers who are still thinking that there's some magic that they want to, you know, get in a bottle. But anyway, so I'm very indebted to Wally. But
so there anyway, you were teaching English, doing English instruction at Stanford and working on the Great American Hippie novel, right?
Yeah, right. And I finished the Great American Hippie novel, it was a little too late for the Great American Hippie novel. It was 1974 by then. America was really sick unto the point of death with hippies. Nixon had stomped George McGovern in the 1972 election. And at that point, the 60s were kind of over. It was clear that you know, any of these foolish dreams of revolution or radical change were not being embraced by, you know, the majority of Americans. And that was very depressing to me, although, of course, those of us who didn't like Richard Nixon got our comeuppance within the next 19 months as, you know, his presidency unraveled in Watergate. But because the great hippie novel was not finding a lot of customers in New York, that is to say, zero of the 23 publishers who read it, I had to think about, you know, what else I was going to do with the time that I wasn't writing. And I did not want to become an English professor. I had blundered into that. I had nice opportunities in the academic world, but I just didn't want to do it. And I started to say, well, you know, what are my alternatives? And somewhat shocking to me, I found that my friends who were practicing law were doing stuff that I thought was fascinating, especially the ones who were doing criminal law. I remember going up to Washington State to visit my friend Jay Rich, my college roommate and still dear friend. And he had a job as a King County district attorney. And I remember watching him, he was trying just simple little misdemeanor cases to start, and literally reading his questions out of a script that he'd been given. But I still thought it was incredible and dramatic. And so I began to think, well, you know, law school? And, you know, my dad hated lawyers. I really didn't know any lawyers, had no idea what they did. But the more I learned, the more fascinating it seemed to me. And so I decided to do it and ended up with a contract to write that book you held up before, 1L.
Well, I thought that was the genesis of 1L, so interesting to me, but because the great American hippie novel didn't work and you got a publishing contract to take it to law school and wrote this wonderful, it's called A Turbulent True Story of a First Year at Harvard Law School. And you can imagine when I read it, when you published it, I think it was, what, 77?
77.
Right. That my own experience having, you know, reading the law was, I just couldn't imagine law school. And yeah. So you were the window to it. And part of me went, thank God I'm not there.
Yeah.
And part of me went, I really wish I could have had that experience because you brought it to life so amazingly. And you've written a new afterword to it. Do you think it's still relevant?
I think there have been a lot of changes to legal education, but the one part of it where 1L captures an essential truth is that virtually all law students experience law school as a kind of identity crisis because, you know, the approach to the law is to change the way you approach problems, to replace intuition with reason and articulation, to challenge values. And a lot of people experience that and the fact that they've got to master a new vocabulary as being a fundamental change to the way they are in the world. And because law school compresses that experience so much into the first year, there's something especially dramatic about that and even painful. And even though professors engage less often in the kinds of harsh interrogations that were common in some of my law school classrooms, you know, I don't think it's acceptable anymore for a professor to deliberately humiliate a student, which was certainly common when I was a law student. People still, even in gentler times, experience the same sense of not knowing exactly who they are partway through that first year. And because of that, 1L remains current. It's 43 years now. The book is still in print, as you're holding up, the most recent edition proves. I was, for the 40th anniversary, I was invited back to Harvard Law School, and I went. And, no matter how much people want to say that things have changed, they were in their third week in school then. And among the 1Ls that I met, there was a lot of naked panic. I remember a young man I'd gotten to know in Chicago had helped a little bit. He apologized that he couldn't come to my presentation because he had a legal methods paper due the next day. And, he was just in a state of high anxiety about it. He couldn't do anything but work on that paper. And I understood. He was just where I was 40 years before.
So maybe part of this was, to toughen you up for combat, because if you're going to be a trial lawyer, it is a combat of a sort. I always liked Shakespeare's Richard II, which I thought was a great dramatization, of a champion on either side and how it all works out. And certainly Sandy Stern seems to grasp that, he's defending his longtime friend, despite all of the problems, but nonetheless, it's a contest all the way through.
Yeah, you're right. I think Stern believes in the law. Oddly, Barbara, this is the first time I've asked myself if Sandy Stern believes that the adversary system, which is what we call what goes on in the courtroom, is the best way to come at the truth. He probably does more than I do, I'm not sure how he feels about that. So that means that you've asked a really interesting question.
I found quite a lot of ambiguity into him. I thought, he took time out in the middle to have lunch with his client and his client's wife and let that reframe some of what he was thinking about. He wasn't about winning at all costs. He was more about, trying to get to the truth of the matter and do the best he could for his friend, but also for the other people concerned. And yeah. I thought you played him up against the unscrupulous personal injury firm really well. Personal injury lawyers, many of them are great, but some of them, in fact, do ambulance chasing, or in this case, in your book, take it even further down the road.
Yeah, the particular personal injury lawyers in this case, maybe what they're chasing is a personal jet, but they're very successful, quite underhanded, and particularly in the way they acquire cases, which is the sort of gooey center of the personal injury practice, because a lot of those lawyers are very dedicated to their clients and very dedicated to vindicating their interests. But getting the case through the door is something where there are, many fewer rules. And so all of this has, the personal injury lawyers have a lot to do with the plot of the last trial, but we don't spend a lot of time focusing on their activities. It's all about what Stern is doing in the courtroom defending his old friend, this Nobel Prize winner who's now been accused of fraud and insider trading and even murder in securing the approval of an anti-cancer medication. So
as Sandy has resolved that this will be his last trial, one of the first, I didn't think it's a spoiler, one of the first things he has to face is the fact that his daughter, Marta, whom he thought was going to carry on with the Stern firm, forever, she's a generation younger. Clearly, she's his daughter, but she is also going to retire. So yeah. The question I started to ask myself was Marta in love with the law the way Sandy was in love with the law, because she was going to walk away from it?
Yeah, I think Stern concludes, and let me back up for 1 second to say the point where Marta Stern tells her father that she is going to retire. Novelists always talk about how the characters have a life of their own and they can surprise you. When Marta Stern announced that she was going to retire, I found my own jaw dropping, because I had not even considered that possibility. And it leads Stern to think about the fact that her commitment to the law has been great, but you know, at the end of the day, I would say Marta loves her father more than she loves the law. And her joy in the practice of law has been, despite the fact that she's been very, very good at it, but her joy has really been in being able to practice beside her father for 30 years. And now that she's in her late 50s and she's married to a guy who's been very successful financially, and her mom was flat out rich and left her money. You know, she's at the stage in her life where she says, you know, what do I need this for? You know, the deadlines, the consuming anxiety of trying cases. I've done it. I got nothing left to prove to myself, and I'm not going to do it anymore. And probably the hardest part of that decision is telling her father, which she does right at the beginning of the last trial. And so the last trial is not only Stern's last trial, but also the last trial for the law firm of Stern and Stern, since Marta is also going to ride into the sunset like her dad.
Well, we can get to a little ray of hope for the future, but I wanted to circle back to what I was talking about originally, about beginnings. So you spent time in California, you spent time in the East twice, in Amherst and Harvard, but you came back to Evanston, Chicago, to practice law. I think that, you know, high school and where we grew up just shapes us so profoundly. And do you think that there's a kind of Midwest ethic that, you know, informs you all your life, as opposed to whether you were, let's say, grew up in California or grew up in the East? And is that reflected in your books? Why else would you have Kendall County, through what now 11 books, really be Chicago, or at least Metro Chicago?
Yeah, Chicago made a little bit smaller. You know, I have found Chicago to be a fantastic place, both to have raised my kids and to have practiced law. And there is a kind of plainness and centeredness that is just characteristic of the Midwest and of Chicago. You got this big, brawny, striving city, but it's not New York and it's not LA. You know, LA, everybody is still somehow under the influence of the entertainment industry. New York, everybody is, you know, it's a city full of immigrants striving, and people are always climbing all over each other to get somewhere. You know, Chicagoans are frankly nicer than that. But they've come there or stayed there for one reason. They want to work. They want a job. They want to support their families. They want to raise their kids. They want their kids to grow up to be decent people. And that's, you know, that's very characteristic of the whole city. And Midwesterners, especially when you meet them elsewhere, and we now spend a lot of time down here in Naples, Florida, where I'm talking to you, they all share this perspective that they are, you know, they're a little bit of a different breed. Oddly, you know, the people we seem to have the most in common with down here in Florida are the Canadians, the people from Toronto, especially, who, you know, Toronto is a city a lot like Chicago, and they seem to be a common breed with us.
Well, you know, there were rhythms of life in the Midwest. I've been in Arizona for 36 years, and yet I still can't quite get past the concept of seasons, you know, of seasonal food, a whole pattern of life. And for the 4 years, 5 years that I was at Stanford, I never could get used to the big body of water being to the west.
Yeah.
I was always disoriented geographically, you know, because the lake is such a major part of it. But I felt that Kendall County really, you know, as the background for so many of your books, really is really you, you know, writing about Chicago and your experience.
There's no question. I've never even tried to pretend on that one. I mean, Kendall County is an imagined landscape, but, you know, the political dynamics, the ethnic relations, racial relations, it's all Chicago. There's just no doubt about it, you know, including the road construction. So it's, you know, there's the saying in Chicago, there are two seasons. There's winter and road construction. It's hard to know which is worse. So it's no doubt about it. It's just a little bit smaller so that the novelist can get around there and knows all parts of town.
So Sandy first appeared to represent Rusty in Presumed Innocent, if I remember right.
Correct.
I want to throw out to you an idea that has come to me recently, because at the moment, domestic suspense and the whole trust no one genre, you know, is largely taken over as a kind of a big thing. I think that Presumed Innocent was, in fact, not just maybe a pioneering legal thriller after Anatomy of a Murder, but I think it was really the big first Trust No One book. And I say that because the paperback came out. I opened The Poison Pen in 1989. So the paperback had just recently come out. And I'm telling you, Scott, that people used to stand at the checkout counter and argue over who did it and how it happened. It was in the movie, I think, that it had to be clarified. But people who read the book really came away with that same feeling that you had after Gone Girl or The Girl on the Train or some of these classics.
Right.
Have you thought about that?
You know, I occasionally, because Gillian Flynn is a Chicagoan, people have talked to me about the resemblance of the two books. And But beyond that, no. And, you know, Gone Girl obviously is an achievement in its own right, and one of a high order. But it's certainly the case that I knew that Rusty was not the most reliable of narrators, and. I thought personally that the reason for that was that he was, as he is, you know, as he still is 20 years later in Innocent, he's somewhat self-deceived, and maybe to a greater extent than is true of most people. So he doesn't quite see things clearly. He doesn't see his wife clearly. He doesn't see his marriage clearly. And, you know, he misperceives his boss at work, you know, Raymond Horgan. And as I said, 20 years later in Innocence, he's still the same guy. But I hadn't quite thought of it as as Trust No One being a genre. But I'm interested in that observation.
I didn't think it was a genre when you wrote it, but it's become one. And now reflecting back, I realize that how important Presumed Innocent was in that development. How do you feel about, there's a new movie version of it being done, right?
There is, I'm not, the plan is for a streaming series. I'm not at liberty to say any more than that. So we'll see how that goes. I like the people who are involved in it. And the one thing I will tell you that has been really weird, Barbara, is that three different people had come to me in the last 4 months, really respected people in the entertainment industry, all with the idea of reprising Presumed Innocent as a streaming series. I guess its time has come, and we'll see how it works out.
Well, it was a tremendous bestseller, but I think it will be interesting to see how people react to it now when, you know, there are many more books with unreliable narrators and so forth than at the time. And I was glad to see that you mentioned Anatomy of a Murder, you know, as a precursor to Presumed Innocent. I absolutely love that book. And do you realize, I thought about it several times, there are hardly any judges that actually write crime fiction or thrillers, but Robert Travers was one.
He was an appellate court judge, and I forgot his real name, John. It was actually a Dutch name. I can't remember his last name right now. Although when Presumed Innocent came out, I got a really gracious letter from him, because the comparisons had begun then and of course continue to this day. There are a few judges who write. There was a judge named Torres in New York who wrote a series of crime novels. My friend Jim Zagel, who's a federal judge in Chicago, has written a couple of novels, including a novel called Money to Burn, about a federal judge who masterminds a theft from the Chicago Federal Reserve Bank. But they have a hard time doing it because the Supreme Court doesn't want them, at least the federal judges, publishing books in their own name. So I think you might say they're discouraged.
They are. My very favorite is a British author, Cyril Hare, which is a pseudonym for a British judge who in the 1930s was still rode circuit with trumpeters before him and sat on a woolsack. And it too is a trust no one or an unreliable narrator. Francis Pettigrew is the lawyer. It's a fabulous book. It's one of my maybe top five favorite mysteries of all time.
Cyril Hare?
Cyril Hare, CYRILHARE, and it's called Tragedy at Law.
Okay.
So, it comes into print from time to time, but I recommend it. Anyway, we've gone all around the burn, but I haven't really given you a chance and to talk about the last trial. So we have Sandy and we have his daughter, and they are up against a federal prosecutor here. And it's a complicated case because it involves potential murder charge. It has insider trading. It requires a lot of medical evidence about, trials. It's incredibly relevant when you think about this rush to vaccine. And then you think about this. I mean, obviously you wrote it long before this pandemic came along, but much of what you talk about is likely very much to come in play right now.
Yeah, to make the listeners and viewers, to bring them up to speed. Sandy Stern, at 85, is asked by his longtime friend, Kirill Pafko, a former Nobel Prize winner in medicine, to defend Kirill against charges that he secured FDA approval of a significant cancer medication called G-Livia, which is, frankly, very helpful to many cancer patients. But he neglected to inform the FDA at the time that it kills a certain number of them after about a year of use because of acute allergic reactions. And so he is charged with fraud, mail fraud, racketeering, insider trading, and even murder. Sandy is, frankly, almost gleeful at the notion that at the age of 85, he's going to be able to try yet one more high-profile case. His daughter thinks he's out of his mind, and that because he himself is a cancer patient, that he's not up to the rigors of this. But he feels an obligation to Kirill Pafko because Kirill, in fact, gave him perhaps the first human doses of G-Livia, and it has prolonged Stern's life. And he also found in Kirill a magic almost as a treating physician that he is still grateful for, because he thought he had reached the end of his life, and somehow in Kirill's care, he suddenly found himself hopeful. He really felt his life had revived. And so he can't turn away from Pavko. And yet Pavko is not somebody that Stern has ever thought he really knew at the core. And as Stern thinks to himself at one point, becoming someone's criminal defense lawyer is, generally speaking, not the way to improve your opinion of that person. And that certainly proves to be the case with Pavko. At the heart of the government case against him, very earnest, competent U.S. attorney, Moses Appleton, who's also somebody who's appeared before in the stream of Kendall County novels. At the heart, of course, is the FDA drug approval process. Little did I know at the time that it would be as relevant as it is in the midst of what I call the damdemic, because of course everybody is, you know, on pins and needles. When will there be a vaccine? You know, what medications moderate the effect of this virus? And I think I hope people pick up The Last Trial, because it's a great suspenseful story, but they will certainly learn a lot in passing about what goes on with the FDA. And, you know, at the heart, what confronts the FDA, what confronts Pavko, what confronts Stern, and what confronts the jury is a very complicated moral question, which is, do we allow a medication that saves many to come onto the market knowing it will take the lives of a few? And how much warning do the few deserve before they are killed by this medication they think is going to save them? And that's what's at the heart of The Last Trial and the crime that Pavko is accused of. Pavko, of course, says he's innocent. He never did it, which is a challenge to Stern, although he's accustomed to his clients telling him they're innocent, and that often proving not to be the case.
If you read the Wall Street Journal, they actually had something in it today about pressure to deliberately infect people. I'm hoping surely volunteers, with the virus, in the thought that they may be able to speed up looking for antibodies or a vaccine or something. It brushed over all these questions about, you know, what if people die? Are the people running the test then going to be accused of murder? You know, will there be claims for compensation by victims' families if people die, so forth? All questions you raise in The Last Trial.
Yeah.
But a big part of The Last Trial, too, is the very complicated nature of parents and children, of husbands and wives. And you even bring in the immigrant experience, because Pavko and his wife, Donatella, are from Argentina. It's an enormous, there's a tremendous scope in the novel. And you do have to read it, I think, paying attention to all the different threads in it to make any sense out of the way it concludes.
Yes, well, that is true. I've never tried to write easy books. As the many nice reviews that appeared today have pointed out, and I'll take their endorsement to heart, that, you know, this is a page turner. But to get the most out of it, you do have to pay attention to the details. But as you point out, it's as much about families as it is about insider trading or drug trials. And you know, at the core of it are, you know, the loves and frictions within Stern's own family. He's now lost two wives, and he's taking account of that as his life moves towards its end. He works with his granddaughter, who is without question a very difficult young woman. He looks over on the first day of trial with a sense of relief because she's actually come to work. And it wouldn't be the first time that she just didn't show up. Marta, if she had her way, would have fired the granddaughter long before. But the progress of Stern's relationship with his granddaughter and, you know, what he ultimately thinks to himself about her is another of those things that happened unbidden and that I take enormous satisfaction in the last trial.
Pinky is a truly wonderful character. I think many of us would love to see her become the centerpiece of a new book.
That's certainly what I'm attempting at the moment. Writing in the voice of somebody who's 33 years old, when you are not 33 years old, is a challenge. And of course, if I fail at that, I can go to the third person. But I have this tremendous intuition that if I can master her voice, it will be amusing as hell. Not just to my children, but to me. And I say that because I think she is a person of original perspectives, and her observations on the world will be both funny and winning for readers. So I'm very impressed with the plot that I've dreamt up for this new book, but I shouldn't say much more about it, except that I thought, I was poking away at it. And then I had one of these moments where the hairs on my arm stood on end, and I realized I had the ultimate twist in the book, and I thought it was terrific. We'll see if I can execute.
I'm sure you can. Let me check with Patrick to see if we have questions from the audience. Patrick, he does. He said we have a lot. So he's going to come over here so you can hear him.
I don't know about a lot, Scott, but Angie Kim and Hank Philippi Ryan are both watching. Angie's in bed sick, but she just wants me to tell you that I love Scott in his books and totally regard him as the father of modern courtroom dramas. And both she and Hank said that actually reading 1L inspired them to go to law school. So that's nice. Questions, let's see here.
We should stop and, those are both terrific writers. Angie, of course, won the Edgar last week for the best first novel. So we should doff our caps to her, and I'm sure she's, pleased as punch and deserves to be. Miracle Creek is a terrific novel. Okay, moving on.
All right. Here's a question about your book, Innocent, which came out some years ago. It says, what was it like revisiting the characters in Innocent after so much time had passed since Presumed Innocent? Was it a challenge to get back into the characters and move them ahead to the current time?
Well, first of all, that's an astute question because it's equally applicable to the last trial. After Presumed Innocent, I wrote The Burden of Proof. Stern was the main character. Stern loiters in all of the subsequent novels and certainly makes a major reappearance in Innocent, where he is yet again the defense lawyer. So this is the second time I've re-inhabited the skin of a character that I, walked with at length many years before. And when Presumed Innocent came out, there were certainly a lot of people who wanted me to write the next Rusty Savage novel. And I didn't want to write, what I regard as the typical series because as good as so many of these series are, the character is essentially fixed in time. They don't age much. They don't change much. They are whoever they are in the first book. And the great challenge of writing The Last Trial, in which Stern is now 30 years older than when he first appeared, or Innocent, where Rusty was 25 years older, is you're meeting a different person. Rusty Savage in Innocent has gone from, you know, the striving young prosecutor to the chief judge of the appellate court, a great success, in part, ironically, because he was acquitted of a murder that he's widely viewed as not having been responsible for. In Stern's case, he was a great success when we met him. He is now at the end of that arc, and he's facing, he's making peace with his career and the life he's led, and frankly, judging it against his clients who, by, you know, external standards, the memory of history, because he's a former Nobel Prize winner, is certainly going to be remembered, as Stern says, long before, you know, the winds of time have blown away any remnant of the memory of Sandy Stern. And yet he can't simply, you know, dismiss that and give it the back of his hand. And he spends a lot of time taking account of the life he's lived, the women he married, the children he parented, and his long, complex, and ultimately very satisfying relationship with the law, and whether he's given it too much at the cost of the people he's loved. So he's a much different guy now than he was when he was dealing with the death of his first wife and the burden of proof. And meeting these characters again has not been very hard. I found it easy to reaccustom myself to their voices. But dealing with who they are in their lives now has been the really interesting challenge. And I've enjoyed it both times. You know, I'm proud of both books. They certainly stand alone by themselves and were meant to. But it's, you know, it's like hanging around again with an old friend, and a friend who's 30 years older and is different in some way. And there's a lot of discovery in that.
There's kind of a related question here that actually one viewer has posed, and it's caused a bit of dialogue between the other people watching the program. And that question is simply, do I need to reread Presumed Innocent before I read The Last Trial? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, as I said before, the book is meant to stand alone. And in the case of The Last Trial versus The Burden of Proof, or Presumed Innocent, those events are really in the background. And whatever you need to know about what took place in those novels is dealt with in a couple of sentences in The Last Trial. So I think it's very much a standalone, and, you know, novelists spend a lot of time, you know, not paying attention to critics, but of course, when they love your book, then, you know, you think they're the fount of all wisdom. So, because everybody who's written about this book seems to like it so much, I dwell on their wisdom, which is that, you know, the novel stands by itself.
Well, a lot of your viewers disagree. They think that you should go back and read the first ones before.
I'm happy to have people do it, believe me.
Let me see here. There is a question, kind of a writerly question, which is, can you tell us how you begin the writing process for a book? Are you an outliner? And let's see, do you know the end when you start the book? And finally, what's your editing process like? Are you revising as you're writing?
The last question is the easiest one to answer, which is I revise as I write. When I've completed a draft, that just is the beginning of the next revision. And usually I go through four distinct drafts. I certainly did with the last trial, and that's been common. I can't even remember when it wasn't. It's the beginning process that's more unusual. If I talk about the last trial, we've mentioned Innocent, and Sandy Stern was, he had a prominent role in Innocent where he's defending Rusty Savage yet again. And somehow I got the idea that Stern was dealing with a serious cancer. He had advanced metastatic lung cancer and tries the case, in suits that swim on him, that are, eight sizes too big. He's haggard and he's got a terrible rash on his face as a side effect of one of the chemotherapies that he's been taking. And, he looks like he's on his last legs, and readers were quick to write to me and say, please don't say Sandy Stern is going to die. And, it's a little bit like Tiny Tim and Dickens. And my instinctive response was, no, Sandy Stern is not going to die. He's not going to die yet. But I then started to think over the years, well, every time, I wrote him into his minor role in one of the ensuing books, I said, how come this guy is still alive? How can somebody with, stage four metastatic lung cancer live so long with that disease? I mean, it happens, thank God it happens, but it doesn't happen, with huge frequency. So how did that happen? And I thought, well, maybe there was some pioneering therapy. He got into a clinical trial and he was lucky. It worked for him. And so that was literally how I began thinking about this world of cancer medications. Now, once I've got the germ of that idea, I'm both rereading the novels where Stern has appeared before, so I can reacquaint myself with the actual details of his world and with his sensibility, which is a good way to start. I'm doing research, and I'm feeling my way along in the plot. And I'm just making notes and writing scenes, doing character sketches, and somewhere in that process, Marta announces that she's going to retire, to the shock of the author and her father. The granddaughter, Clarice or Pinky, shows up and is her own difficult and arresting self. And, the book begins to take form in this fashion I have of just poking around with it for about a year. After a year, I've got a lot of notes. Nothing is sequenced. And so I begin what I refer to as the first draft, and begin trying to write a continuous story from point A to point Z. And when I have, when I've done that, I'll usually go through another draft, and then show it to my wife and then my agent, and assuming both of them have nodded their approval, I will send it to my editor and, get his comments. And then the part that I don't always enjoy begins, where I try to accommodate my editor's commentary. And that's sometimes frustrating. especially when you think you have fixed the problem, and they write back to say, no, you haven't. But it's ultimately quite rewarding. And I both love and hate the sort of niggling with sentences that I do in the last stages, where I try to make sure that every sentence is formed well and avoid word repetitions and question word choices. And then, of course, at the last stage is the copy editor. And I have had a blessed relationship with the copy editor at Grand Central. The production supervisor is a woman named Mary Okuda. And she supervises the copy editor. She's phenomenal. And they really saved me from myself. Especially in a book that with a lot of technical detail, they make sure it's actually accurate. They question things. They're like, well, you say on page XO that Stern was 78 at the time, but he's 85 now. And that was 12 years ago, so he couldn't be 78. So what the hell are you talking about? But that part's okay. It's somewhere between the second draft and the fourth draft that there is, you know, as Churchill put it, blood, toil, sweat, and tears. So.
Do you have any pet words that you only allow yourself to use once in a book?
Gee, no. No. I do notice that, you know, a word like toil, for example, little old-fashioned. I will find that word cropping up more than I think it should, especially when I'm rewriting. And I'll literally have in mind these eight passages in the book where the word toil appears and say, okay, you got to put yourself on a toil ration. You can only have three toils in this novel. So decide where it sounds best.
I have a question from Hank Philippi Ryan, who asks, or she says, I love what Scott said about finding the truth and getting justice. Is that, quote, easier in a book than in real life? Hmm. Can there be a different meaning to justice?
Well, that's a complicated question. And, as Hank well knows herself, we do deal in crime fiction with the convention that the bad guy has to get discovered, at least. And generally, public tastes are to be satisfied, punished, although I've always resisted that one. So that's the convention. But, you know, and whether that's true at the end of the last trial, I'll let readers judge. But I increasingly subscribe to something that Sandy Stern thinks to himself, which is that justice, at least as he thinks of it as a lawyer, is not just one outcome. And if you're committed to the law, then you have to accept the range of outcomes. As he's facing the end of Kirill Pavko's trial, he realizes that his client could be found guilty across the board and imprisoned the rest of his life. He could be found guilty of some of the charges, so he has a chance perhaps of coming out of prison before he dies, or he can be acquitted. And the truth of the matter is, as Stern looks at the evidence, he realizes that all three of those alternatives are rational and perhaps just outcomes. Now, the reader's going to say, well, wait a minute. You know, the guy either did it or he didn't do it. And it's certainly not justice to imprison an innocent person. And with that, we can all agree. But in some ways, Stern is willing to let his own assumptions, which are, generally speaking, his client must be guilty. So any of those outcomes is okay with him.
I have a customer who says, her name is Janie, and she says, "To Kill a Mockingbird made me want to be a lawyer." I suspect that's true for a lot of people. Was that an influential book for you, or were there other books that kind of inspired you to become a lawyer?
Well, I loved and love To Kill a Mockingbird. You know, it really is, these days, taken to be, with good reason, the great American novel. And it's an extraordinary achievement. But it didn't drive me toward being a lawyer, largely because I grew up in a household. My dad was a doctor. And as I like to put it, he was a prophet in his own time, in the sense that he hated lawyers long before it was common for doctors to do that. And he was a very emotional guy. He just didn't understand the way lawyers went at the world, and you know, that this hyper rationality that they all preach and practice. So I grew up feeling that whatever it is lawyers did was, that it wasn't related to me. And you know, even though, how could you not admire Atticus Finch? And of course I did, like so many other readers. You know, if anything should have awakened me to my interest in the law, it wasn't really To Kill a Mockingbird. It was my addiction to the Perry Mason television show, which, you know, we're talking about a 10-year-old now. I just never missed it on Saturday night. I loved it, and I couldn't explain to myself why I loved it. I just, something about it worked. And I think, you know, that certainly planted in me one idea about the nobility of the criminal defense lawyer.
So Scott, we've been thrilled to share this on sale date with you, the debut of this novel formally. And I realized that in all the characters we've talked about, there is a pivotal character we haven't mentioned who really in many ways holds the whole thing together. And that's the judge.
Yeah.
Whose personal and ethical dilemmas are fascinating, as well as her control of the trial. And we've seen Sunny before, but in this one, she's really, controlling this trial as best she can, despite all of its complex and diverse elements. She must have been really a joy for you to write.
Yeah. People always say to me, which of your characters do you feel closest to personally? And I always answer, you know, there's parts of me in Rusty Savage, there's big parts of me in Sandy Stern, and there are also large portions of me in Sonny Klonsky. And Sonny first appears in The Burden of Proof as a prosecutor. Later in The Laws of Our Fathers, she has become a judge. She's a state court judge there. If you read carefully, you can see that she's been appointed to the federal bench, although that's way in the background of some of the earlier books. And by now, she's now the chief judge of the federal court in Kendall County and the presiding judge in this trial, and is really forced to take this case by an odd set of circumstances. The Sterns, Martha Stern is, you know, BFF with with Sonny Klonsky. Stern and she have very close personal relationship. And it so happens that the U.S. attorney, Moses Appleton, was her most frequent trial partner when they were both young prosecutors. And what's complicated is that Moses is now the U.S. attorney. And she can't disqualify herself from all of his cases because the U.S. attorney is in name the government's only representative in federal court. So he's got an interest in every case. And because of that, she leaves it up to the lawyers and says, when the case is drawn to her randomly, she says, look, you want me to stay on the case, I'll stay. And if you have any qualms about this, just let my clerk, Luis, know, and I'll remove myself from the case. So, you know, Sonny as a personality emerges again in ways that I did not expect in this book. She, because I sort of idolize her in a lot of ways, she turns out to be more short-tempered than I expected. And, you know, there are times she flies off the handle at the lawyers and doesn't give them enough of a chance to explain themselves. But she's a really good judge. She's a really good judge. She knows the law. She knows the rules of evidence. She controls her courtroom. She's civil most of the time, but even with the close friends who are trying the case in front of her, she never lets them forget who's in charge of the courtroom. And she's an interesting figure.
She is an interesting figure, and she's an essential figure. Without her, it would be chaos. And so she really does hold us all together. Scott, you've been amazingly generous with your time. I'm so glad we got to share a part of this exciting day with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Barbara. It has been an exciting day. It's been great for me. You know, you write a book, takes years, and then you kind of hold your breath to see what's going to happen. So it's been a great day. I've had a wonderful time, and Adrian and I are now going to cook a steak and open a bottle of wine and celebrate. So, and thank you to everybody who's been watching the two of us. And as always, Barbara, thank you to you. You run one of the premier independent stores in the United States, and your love of books over and above everything else is always, always clear. And it's that passion that independent booksellers bring that really is fundamental to the literary culture of the United States. So I salute you for your role in that.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to think that that lawyer so long ago had a better reading of who I am than I did. So thank you all very much for joining this. This was a discursive program, but you know, it was a wonderful chance to go over not just this book, but much of Scott's life and his process and so forth. So if you want to cut to the chase, you can skip the first 30 minutes, but I think it's really a fascinating hour. And I thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, you can buy an autographed copy of The Last Trial here at the Poison Pen. And I'm also going to give a shout out to the audiobook, which is terrific. So good night.
Thank you, Barbara.
We're gone. I did want to tell you that my husband listened to the audiobook and absolutely loved it. He thought that it was extremely well done. And I wanted to give it that little shout out there at the end, because not everybody, you know, reads a print book anymore.
No, and I'm a big fan of audiobooks, but I have to tell you that this is the first I've heard about it. In years ago, you know, the author had to be much more involved because they didn't have the capacity to reproduce the entire book, at least on right. one CD or one tape. So you had to approve the script. But I guess I approved the reader way over a year ago. So I know that Grand Central thinks the world of him.
Well, I haven't heard it myself, but Rob's a pretty good critic of audio, and he spends a lot of time driving. So, you know, he's particularly fond of listening to him, and he thought this was, he gave it a big rave. He's from, you know, a Chicago family that helps define Chicago, because he's Julius Rosenwald's great-grandson. Right.
And then his grandfather was a client of my still law firm, now called Denton's, but long called Sonnenschein. And
we've been taken to the Standard Club by friends to eat and seen, you know, Julius over the fireplace or wherever he is. I like to go visit the glass at the Art Institute, but my acquaintance with Rob, I'll let you go here, but you probably don't know this, is that I eventually ended up as a librarian at the Library of Congress. That was my second or third master's, I can't remember, before I wound up reading the law. And while I was there, Lessing Rosenwald, Julius's son, who moved Sears to Philadelphia, because you probably don't know this either, that's where his principal book collector worked. A very famous guy named, what was his name? Rosenthal, I think, was a premier authority on books. Anyway, Lessing, while I was there as a intern and working in gifts in exchange, decided to donate his collection to the Library of Congress. But it was a little complex, because the deal was that the title of the books would pass to the library, but Lessing would get to keep the books in Alverthorpe, his estate outside Philadelphia, until he died. So he and Edith came to the library, and I was part of the team that worked with him to bring that collection into the library. So some years later, when I married Rob, Lessing had died, but his wife, Edith, was still alive, and Rob and I went to visit Alverthorpe. And so I had the weird experience of the books transferring to the library, but I never saw the books in the Library of Congress. And then I went to Alverthorpe, but the books by then had left for the Library of Congress. And so all we had left were the bookshelves. But the Library of Congress, there's a funny, Rob and I did a program for them some years ago, still on their website, but they refer to themselves as the Yenta of our relationship. So, very few people could say that, probably only us. But, you know, the whole Chicago connection, Ravinia was their summer home. You know, when I was a kid, we called it the Rosenwald Museum. We didn't call it the Museum of Science and Industry.
Yeah, we still called it the Rosenwald when I was a kid. Certainly my mother did.
Yeah, and Rob and I had been to Munich to visit the famous museum in Munich that Lessing modeled it on. You know, even though I haven't lived in Chicago since I did my graduate work at Northwestern, our roots are tremendous there. Yeah. And, you know, it's a wonderful city. And I think of it when I read your books with Kendall County. I love books in which the landscape and the culture are just as much a character as the characters.
Yeah, well, thank you. I've lived in fear of the movie company coming along that says, we have to own Kendall County too, because that would be more depressing than losing control over the characters.
So, it would be really hard. Can they actually do that? Can they claim it's a character? And
they could. There actually was a discussion recently about doing exactly that, and I wouldn't put it entirely out of reach, but talk about a complicated legal problem.
Absolutely. David Morrell and I are very good friends, and over time when I visited him in Santa Fe, we have talked forever. The only thing he kept when he sold First Blood to the movies was, I'm trying to remember, it was like the t-shirt and some other weird right, but everything else went to Hollywood. However, the success of the franchise has given him, just from those weird little residual rights.
Yeah, from the t-shirts, I'm sure.
Yep, a tremendous income. And so we are the Outlander bookstore. Diana is my neighbor. So we've had many long conversations about, you know, what happened when our Outlander sold to Stars. And so we have all this merch here, we call it, that is related to Outlander. And Diana is a real saint because she doesn't make any money from it because of the way that deal was structured. But she is so good about coming down and signing, you know, like calendars and peripheral stuff and so forth. It's so complicated, but the truth is, I think you can negotiate pretty much your own deal if you just, you know, there's no end.
Although they hold on to merchandising.
Now they do. Yeah.
You have an easier time getting a bone out of a tiger's mouth. They are ferocious about it. So.
Well, they are, but that's because they also learned that's where the money is.
They certainly can make money. I'm not sure that Sandy Stern t-shirts are going to be quite the,
quite no, the thing, the first blood t-shirt.
Well, go and enjoy your wine and your steak. It's been great to visit with you, Scott. It's been a long time.
Thank you.
I hope we'll get to do it again with your next book.
I hope so too. Thank you. Okay. And I hope it's better times when we can be together personally. So.
Well, I do too. But you know what? There's been a bonus to this in that we've had a chance to connect with people that we might not necessarily see. Ian Rankin and I had a fabulous hour yesterday. He in Edinburgh and me here where
normally he's a nice guy.
He's fabulous. And you would really enjoy it if you have time to listen to it. But, you know, normally we wouldn't have an hour together in May. You know, it just wouldn't work out.
The last time I saw Rankin, he told me, I was just amazed that he and J.K. Rowling and somebody else, they all lived
on the Alexander McCall Smith.
Yeah, they all lived on the same block.
They do. Yep, I've been to have coffee with Ian, and he's now moved, but it was a huge Victorian, and they all lived together in this one kind of gated community.
Yeah.
But they sold it, and now he lives in a flat further into Edinburgh, and he spends a lot of time in Cromarty, which is a little town very far up north in Scotland. But he's quarantined in Edinburgh because there's really no medical care in Cromarty. Plus, he doesn't want to be like the New Yorkers who've been criticized, you know, for going to their summer places and taking things with them. So
they took the disease with them, yeah.
Yeah, but he's a lovely guy, and I really enjoyed the conversation, and he and Patrick spent a lot of time talking about guitars and music and all the rest of it. Anyway, enjoy your evening, and we'll
stay. Thank you, Barbara. Okay?
Bye.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.